Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Van Weva, and alongside me, as always, is Mr. Shad Sir Lancelot Riley.
I wish I had a better sound effect than shwing, which is what came to mind, so I'll just go with it.
Also with us, we have Spencer Morgana Williams.
Awful, just
I
terrible.
I thought you were going to say peasant or something. That's... I don't know how I feel about that. It's probably worse.
Well, we'll talk about how you feel about the film when we get into our review this week of The Kid Who Would Be King. The film dropped this past weekend, so we're going to talk about that a little bit more as the show goes on. But before we do, Chad is going to give you a little bit of the opening credits.
Okie dokie, The Filmlosophers is your once and future podcast, and our timeless evaluations of recent films are like an audio anthology brought to you by Mingle Media TV and VGB Studios. Whether you're thirsting for new adventures, astute philosophical commentary, fresh frights, or a dash of whimsical romance.
That's a very...
We've got a bit of everything for you. New episodes of The Filmlosophers drop each Wednesday morning on the world's most prestigious streaming platforms, including Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Libsyn, Player FM, and Audio Boom.
We have something much bigger than our round table for sharing opinions and advice.
Actually, our table's square, but just so you know. Just
well, now you're just ruining like the illusion. It's over. You can follow us on Facebook.
It's a folding table.
Such monsters.
We take it with us.
And don't give away our secrets, Eddie.
They all know.
We used to play cards on it.
Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/philosophy101. Like pulling a sword from the stone, you never know what new journey awaits when you sample our digital archive. Every episode we've recorded is available at filmlosophers.com. And we don't charge you a dime for the experience. But maybe we should start since, you know, we're not making any money off this thing.
It's true, we're not making a dime. We're doing it for the love of it, and we love movies.
Yeah, poor
That's
people.
That's why we're still at a folding table.
That's right. But speaking of tables... we will be talking about the latest film that came out this past weekend, The Kid Who Would Be King. If you've been aware of any of the smaller, more independent films, obviously, we're in the middle of the beginning of 2019, so we've mentioned this last week. Most films at the beginning of the year aren't very much publicized because studios are putting more effort into publicizing their Oscar, you know, their award winners. But this was a film that caught our attention because we have a resident Arthurian historian lover
Spencer
and so we decided to go check it out. So before we jump into the review, Chad, give him that official synopsis goodness.
Yep, and then we're gonna score this at the end. Old school magic meets the modern world in this epic adventure as Alex thinks he's just another nobody until he stumbles upon the mythical sword in the stone, Excalibur. All right, so far. Now he must unite his friends and enemies into a band of knights, and together with the legendary wizard Merlin, take on the wicked enchantress Morgana. Still good. With the future at stake, Alex must become the great leader he never dreamed he could be.
That's
actually an accurate synopsis.
This is wild. It took this long to run into one that was accurate.
Less than 147 people, we finally have a correct synopsis of a film.
Hey, that was directly from Fox. So, directed by Joe Cornish, the film stars Louis Ashbourne Circus, Dean Shamu, Tom Taylor, Rihanna Doris.
Did you just say Shamu?
Shamu? Shamu. Rihanna Doris, Angus Imrie, with Rebecca Ferguson and Patrick Stewart.
Sir Patrick Stewart,
you give that man the respect he deserves.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, just double checking.
Absolutely.
this film, whose title is a playful reference to the title of the 1975 film The Man Who Would Be King, is the sophomore film for Cornish, His first was 2011's Attack of the Block, which where we got the debut of what's his name, the actor from.
That's very helpful.
The actor,
yeah, Finn.
Yes, the guy who played Finn in. The guy who played Finn
fired.
In this, The Force Awakens.
Fired. Both fired. All fired. We're all fired.
You know what? It's not helping. His name is John Boyega. Either way. So, Joe Cornish, this is his sophomore film directing. He's written quite a bit prior to, so he's got a good filmography underneath him as a writer, but this being his second film, you know, you see a lot of the things that were reminiscent from this film that you remembered from Attack the Block. The film marks Patrick Stewart's first Arthurian movie since playing... you're going to have to pronounce this one, Chad. I'm not even going to try.
Well, I would say that there's a misplaced N, but it looks like it's French anyway. Léon de Grance,
the father of Guinevere in 1981's Excalibur. So, like I said, we got a chance to check out this film this past weekend. It was one of the ones that was actually probably the better choice out of what was being played. Not that this wasn't like a last resort type of thing. It was just there wasn't really much playing in the theater in terms of releases.
Yeah, we had limited options. I mean,
yeah.
Like you said, it's Oscar season. If there are new films in the theater, they're pretty much all of them getting a fairly soft launch. And if there are other films in the theater, they're probably being relaunched because of Oscar season.
Yeah.
Or award season. There's more than just the Oscars, people.
True. I had to correct myself.
Hollywood
too.
Has no problem patting itself on the back.
And it's true. Like every theater right now, I don't know if you guys got those same emails, but every single theater chain is putting out those whole like awards passes where you go and you can see all like the the nominees that are being, you know, up for Best Picture or whatnot in like succession in terms of being debuted in the theaters. Actually, Black Panther is supposed to have a whole week. Is it a whole week?
Yeah, it's February 1st through the 7th. AMC theaters are showing Black Panther for free if you sign up.
There you
Wakanda
go.
Forever.
There you go. So, checking this film out, honestly, it was one of those films where I wasn't too sure because I didn't recognize anybody. I didn't even know Patrick Stewart was in this movie until we started watching it. And I was on IMDb waiting for everybody to show up at the theater. And I looked at the very bottom, and it said, Older Merlin, Sir Patrick Stewart. I'm like, oh, okay. I can kind of roll with that. That's a name for familiar. And then, obviously, Rebecca Ferguson, she was in the latest, last two or three Mission Impossible
Mission
movies.
Mission Impossible, yeah.
So,
and she was in The Greatest Showman.
Oh, she was.
She was the opera singer.
Oh,
I don't remember her name, but...
I still haven't seen The Greatest Showman yet, so...
Well, you're about a year and a half behind. Not all that long, but more than a year. You're more than a year behind.
But the thing is that me and Spence, we were kind of just wondering how this film was going. We kind of had a little bit of a hesitancy to see it. But like I said earlier, Chad is a bona fide swords and sandals kind of historical epic type of film kind of guy.
This is true.
And whenever we have done the review of the last King Arthur film, which was The Legend of the Sword.
Lesson 63.
You were the main proponent to talking positively about it, as opposed to kind of the chaos of it all and whatnot. You still were able to find a lot of the gems that you reflected back to some of the books.
Yeah, I have a certain amount of loyalty built into the I don't know if you'd call it a franchise, but the story cycle,
which isn't a bad thing. I mean, that's because you, like I said, you enjoy those types of films. We probably have mentioned this in that episode that you were mentioning for the first time, but what are some of the things about these types of films that you really thrive on? Like what is the allure for you?
Oh, mercy. Well, I mean, who doesn't like knights abiding by a code of honor to band together and cast out evil? I mean, there's a lot of, if you think about, you know, like Joseph Campbell and the hero with a thousand faces, the hero's journey, you know, there's a lot of that sort of timeless motif of the hero who rises up in a dark time, builds a band of allies, and overcomes evil. Now, in the Arthurian cycle, that's not a... he does overcome evil, but then ultimately He is, in most tellings of the story, he is killed later in life. And then Britain enters the Dark Ages kind of with zeal. So it's not like a total, like, and everything was good for all the rest of time, which mm-hmm. is where you get the idea that Arthur will return again, which is something that has been a part of the story cycle for many hundreds of years. And, you know, like basically in Britain's time of need, its greatest champion will rise again. And that's actually one of the things that was really exciting seeing this film.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of do this beautiful, fun, animated title sequence that gives you all the basic knowledge that you need of the Arthurian mythology leading up to the modern day live action portion starring, you know, the kids and
mm-hmm.
eventually Rebecca Ferguson a little bit and Sir Patrick Stewart a little bit, you know, but they did a pretty good job summarizing it at the beginning of the movie. So if you've never really been familiar with King Arthur and how that myth works in like a very broad overview kind of way, just watch the first 3.5 minutes, 4 minutes of this thing and you'll be pretty well caught up.
Now, and I mentioned this in that other episode, the vast knowledge that I had, aside from that last movie, the Guy Ritchie King Arthur film, the amount of knowledge that I have in this story franchise, so to speak, was whatever I've seen in The Sword in the Stone, the cartoon. So,
which is not very accurate. I mean, but it's pointedly so. I mean, it's Arthur as a boy.
Yeah.
Before really the
oh, you're not
man king kind of.
You're not insulting
manifests.
Me. I know that is probably the worst.
And they borrowed a lot from that in this movie too, in terms of Merlin especially.
Yes. But I want to know, Spencer, where does your knowledge lie in terms of what you knew about prior to coming into this film? Like, what were some of the things you knew about when it came to the Arthurian tale? Which I've been practicing saying that correctly all day, so I'm trying to get
it. It's a bit of a mouthful.
Arthurian tale. Arthurian tale. I'll get it right.
Apparently it's the same as you. Sort of. It's that movie, and because I was bored on Sundays as a kid, Princess Guinevere and the Jewel Riders. Those are the only two things.
What? What is that? Princess Guinevere and the Jewel Riders?
Yeah, it was a girl show for little girls. It was based on Princess Guinevere and her Jewel Rider friends.
I've never heard of
how
that.
How do you ride on a jewel?
You ride a jewel?
No, it was like horses, but like they had a
Are the horses jeweled?
Yeah.
Do the horses talk?
I don't remember. I really don't remember much.
I've never heard of that.
I haven't either.
For it being like a weekend cartoon, I figured...
It was Sunday. It was like part of the D team.
Doesn't matter.
The D team.
If there was a time where you can sleep in...
Eddie is kind of the king of Saturday morning cartoons or Sunday morning, probably.
I can't recall any cartoons being on Sunday morning. I remember it's usually golf.
No, like in California, we had like the worst Sunday cartoons. Saturday was great. Sunday, like all the awful cartoons were on.
Princess Guinevere and the... Gem Riders?
Jewel Riders.
That's a fresh one to me.
I think we can safely say that's solidly outside the status quo of the cycle. I'm sure it was delightful.
I'm sure it was not. But like, those are the only two things where like I have a vague idea of what happens in you know, the story of Arthur.
King Arthur.
Yeah, whatever.
Get it right.
He wasn't always a king.
That's true. It's true.
So there you go.
And I think it's safe to say that as many times as we've seen things that we'd hope were like not historically, but like story-wise, they're accurate. There have been so many instances where the Arthurian legend has been just kind of brutally torn apart. And the only reason why I say that is because there was an egregious act towards this story that was input into a franchise not too long ago. And that was Transformers The Last Knight.
Oh, gosh.
Wait, that's what The Last Knight was about?
Yeah, it began.
It began as such. And
I tried to put that out of my memory.
Well, because
I didn't realize you were going to bring that up. This is very painful for me.
Well, because that film completely just pooped on the Arthurian legend.
Basically everything. Yeah.
Like, it made Merlin out to be this drunken sham who only got power when the Transformers at the time who were hiding in a cave would transfer some of the power from their AllSpark into his staff, and then he would use that staff to do tricks.
I mean, it just didn't make any sense. The whole movie.
The face of Spence right now is so wonderful. I'm telling you, you may just have to see that film just to bite the bullet.
That's ridiculous. But, like, that sounds insane because, like, if he can do, like, magic stuff with a staff filled with the AllSpark, couldn't they themselves do stuff?
They didn't want to be seen.
No, like, just in general because, like, besides Transform, they don't really do anything I would classify as magical.
The last film kind of turned like more focused on...
It was very odd. By the way, if you want to hear more about it, our spoiler review of Transformers The Last Night is Lesson 68. But I think the weirdest, kookiest, stupidest part of that whole thing was the fact that they reused Stanley Tucci as a performer. And there was no explanation for why Merlin would be the same look as the person that he played in the movie before that one.
Stanley Tucci has a recurring role in like two of the films prior, like in both of those, and they reuse Stanley Tucci. He's actually Merlin.
Well, and he's like a Steve Jobs meets like Dick Cheney kind of arms dealer kind of
No, he's not character. Lying. He's not
But
lying
then
at
like
all.
Suddenly in The Last Night, he's in the opening sequence in Arthurian England as Merlin. It just was very odd and has nothing to do with this movie.
None at all.
We just like to gripe.
No, we do.
About that franchise.
But I know a lot of, like me personally, I know a lot of like the wrong interpretations probably, but I believe, Chad, you know, like you've been a big fan of this legend for this story for a long time, and every so often, like every few months or so, I see you binging something else that's tied to the Arthurian tale, whether if it's not rewatching the Merlin BBC series or if it's watching, wasn't there a, there was an Arthur series not too long ago.
Stars had Camelot. It was lackluster, but I watched it anyway.
So I think the question I have for you,
Joseph Fiennes, also a very odd choice for Merlin, and people usually don't get Merlin very right. The series did a pretty good job, actually, the BBC series.
Merlin?
Yeah, but that's because it was derivative. It was sort of like him as a youngster.
Mm.
But yeah, the grown Merlin stuff, I mean, the worst that I've seen in live action, the worst was our... I can't even say it. I don't know what year it was. It was about a decade ago or so. It's a movie called The Last Legion. Or the Final Legion or something like that with Colin Firth.
Yes, the modern day one.
Sort of the Arthur of the story and Merlin.
That was the one that takes place in the modern day time, isn't it?
The end of the Roman Empire. Because the Arthurian legends, there's a lot of like carryover in terms of when those stories, the time period that they seem to depict is essentially the downfall of the Roman Empire influence over the United Kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Roman Empire has been kind of in a stalemate against the Picts of, you know, Scotland and the Northern Isles and whatnot and the Celts and all of that everywhere. And as the Roman Empire kind of collapses on itself and divides and divides and divides again, and everything, they pull out of England, and England becomes more of a free-for-all frontier territory, kind of, where those peoples who had been there before are trying to take the land back over, and then you've got eventually you've got like Norsemen and whatnot who are trying to invade.
Yeah.
And so in the midst of all of this strife, you have a sequence of story. So you've got, you know, bards and balladeers going from castle to castle or whatever, many, many hundreds of years later, in most cases, telling these stories as like a romantic version of historical events.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, in the modern day now, there's been a lot of literary work that's been done by very imaginative writers who are trying to kind of give credence to the historical context within which Arthur may have come to fruition. So, because you've got a dash, certainly, of King David from Judeo-Christian
mm-hmm.
literature and belief. You've got some Roman influence. You've got some other influence. A lot of the famous stories are from the Romance period. So, literally, like lays and songs from bards and whatnot, and very romanticized. And they're always rescuing a damsel in distress, or they're pursuing a woman, or a woman's pursuing him, or Lancelot, or, you know, Sir Gawain, or whatever. And you've got the magical elements that are very strong in a lot of British literature, or mm-hmm. even, you know, Irish myth and all that. So, you know, there's a certain respect for the physical world and the spirit world. There are certain places where the barrier is thin between those elements. And so you've got nymphs, and you've got fairies, and you've got all kinds of things in a bunch of different stories, some of which come to play in the Arthurian cycle as well. Yeah. So there's a lot. There's a lot that's been told. It's been going for thousands of years. So
yeah.
There's just over 1,000 years, I guess. Not thousands, plural, but many hundreds.
Well, jumping right in, I kind of want to talk about expectations, because of the fact that I know between myself and Spence, that conversation is going to be very short, but I want to give room for Chad because of the fact that you have a little bit more experience in this area in terms of information to back on and kind of reflect back on, is what I'm trying to say. So just in terms of expectations for me, because of the fact that it was kids, I was really hoping that it just wasn't going to be like hokey, like ridiculous hokey. Like I was really hoping this film wasn't going to be overly I half expected it to be like a BBC Arthurian version of like Diary of a Wimpy Kid. I didn't want it to be ridiculous, and I didn't want it to be kind of like a waste of time. Like every single heart moment is something that's meant for like a 12-year-old who's like, oh, I can do anything. Yeah, thanks, Mom, kind of thing. Like I wanted it to have like just more depth to it because of the fact that the story it's basing it on, like the larger picture, it's a pretty well-known story. People such as Chad and those who, you know, really enjoy this tale that's been told over the course of, you know, centuries after centuries, there's a sense of, you know, expectations and understanding when it comes to seeing an interpretation of that. And so you got to respect, just even if I don't know the full story, I still have a level of respect to say, okay, if this is going to be based on this story, if this is going to be based on that story, I really hope they don't just like make it this ridiculous Sunday morning cartoon, you know, debacle of a film, and it actually have some credence and some good stuff in it. So that was my only expectation, really. I had no idea of anybody who was in the film. I didn't really expect to see any greatness or whatnot in the acting performances. I was just hoping that it was just going to be watchable. Spence, what about you?
Okay. So going into this movie, I was kind of expecting it just to be like a big hot mess of garbage, because like I feel like you and I, Eddie, are kind of on the same page with a lot of this. Like, because it was kids, I was like, this is gonna be kind of dumb, because like these kids are gonna just be taking Instagram pictures and posting it with the sword or something. Like
I half expected that as well.
That's what I was kind of expecting from this movie. And then, like, earlier in the day, I saw, like, Patrick Stewart was in this movie, and I'm like, I don't know how I feel about that. Like, it could go either way. So, that's kind of really all I was...
I haven't been too keen on kind of enjoying a lot of Patrick Stewart's roles as of late. I'm like, I don't know, you should... He's had a pretty long-standing role in Family Guy, so I've been questioning his thoughts as of late.
Yeah.
So, but, I mean, mind you, that was one of the concerns I had, and mind you, it fed into that whole thing. So that's honestly where I was at. And I don't know if you had anything else that you were in terms of expectations.
Yeah, I was just hoping it wasn't going to be like just the worst thing that I've seen this year. That's basically it.
Well, I was just hoping it wasn't going to be like the worst thing. That's nice and low. That bar is hovering just millimeters over the ground.
The bar is so low, it's under the ground. What about you, Chad?
I honestly, expectations going in, I didn't have high expectations because there's a lot of room for when you try to contemporize a story like this, there's just a lot of room for mistakes. Obviously, I'm not a child, although sometimes I behave like one. So I recognized that the audience for the movie, it was very clear in the trailer and the marketing materials, this is a movie for kids. So those of us who are adults who act like kids sometimes.
This movie's for me.
Yeah, something like that. Something a lot like that. So I always take it with a grain of salt because I have to go into certain movies thinking, okay, this, I am not the target audience for this movie, so I have to give it a little bit of grace, knowing that I'm not 10 to 12 years old. However, going into the film, I was intrigued by how they were going to translate the story into the modern day context because we've seen, you know, recently with the Guy Ritchie film, Legend of the Sword, right?
Yeah.
We saw a translation of the Arthurian myth within its own presumed historical context. So not the modern day.
No.
But back in the day, right? And I had some things that I enjoyed about it, mostly Guy Ritchie's style of storytelling and kind of the swagger of the character, even though it didn't super make sense for Arthur. But then there was a lot that, you know, sort of took umbrage with the whole, like, how the sorcery was put into the story and who was doing the sorcery and whatnot. This film, thankfully, did a lot to correct those mistakes, even though it's now in the modern day and has to do some updating. So the way that the characters related to each other and kind of how they reflected the characters from the legend was actually closer than I expected it to be. Like, it was more congruous, the kids in the modern day and then the characters that they were sort of ciphering or emulating.
Okay. Well, jumping right into the film, obviously we're introduced to the main character, which is Alex, played by Lewis Ashbourne Serkis, which, fun fact, by the way, is the child of Andy Serkis and his wife, I believe, Lorraine Ashbourne, both actors in the industry. So the main character is played by pretty much the son of Gollum. this is probably the best way to put it if you're not familiar with the name. Alex is friends with Betters, and they are these two young kids who attend, I believe it's like a middle school. Either middle school or elementary school.
It was like a K through 8 or something.
I thought it was a high school.
It looked like. Like it might have been like, K through 12, actually, because there were younger kids and then there were older kids.
Yeah, I remember the younger kids.
I remember the older kids.
Huh. Wow. Either way, they go to school together.
Things work different in England. We don't know what we're talking about.
They're best friends, and they actually get picked on by two other individuals, Lance and Kay. Lance being played by Tom Taylor and Kay being played by Rihanna Doris. Ultimately, Alex finds the sword in an abandoned construction site, pulls it out of the stone, finds out that it's actually the original Excalibur, knights his friend just playfully. Him, you know, all of a sudden now he's a knight, and the kind of journey ensues to save the world from the dreaded witch Morgana, who has been sleeping under the earth for all this time, and gets sage wisdom from this really awkward young Merlin.
Yeah, very, very awkward. Merlin, it's easy to get Merlin wrong.
I was looking at the list of cast for that film you were talking about, The Last Legion. Ben Kingsley as Merlin?
Yeah, I didn't want to say it because sometimes I do like his performances, but he was awful in that movie. And Merlin was just a train wreck in that movie. That movie was awful. It was bad. At the end of it, there was another person, and I won't repeat verbatim what he said, but as the credits started rolling and people were just kind of sitting there dumbfounded and or laughing so hard that we were crying, one person stood up and basically like yelled at the screen and said, "This movie hurt my soul." And then walked out of the theater dejected. It was so bad.
Oh, man.
You cannot top that.
I wish I was there for that.
I really do wish, too.
Honestly, as soon as he was out, everybody rolled with laughter even harder than we were already laughing because it was so terrible.
So this movie, obviously, we get the younger version or the younger interpretations of this story. It's not so much as him playing Arthur himself, per se. It's not like a reinterpretation of it, but it's a continuation, actually.
They all have similar names. So yeah. Alex is sort of like Arthur. Betters is like Bedivere.
Mm-hmm.
Lance, Lancelot, K. Except for in the Arthurian cycle, K is the adoptive brother of Arthur. So the family of farmers that Arthur goes and lives with for a long time. In several versions of the story, K is the older brother.
Now, out of that's pretty much actually the entire important cast of the entire film. There's not really anybody else.
I mean, Alex's mom is a part of the story here and there, and that's, you know, got a good you know, emotional tie and all that.
Morgana, who, like we mentioned earlier, is played by Rebecca Ferguson. You hear more of her voice and a lot of CG work as opposed to seeing her per se. So, and then even then when you do see her, it's very minimal throughout the course of the film.
Yeah. Well, because they've turned into her into like this creepy underworld vine dragon lady.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's a lot of CG.
And then, as we mentioned, Sir Patrick Stewart does play the older version of Merlin. But that's few and far between as well. You get him maybe three times out of the entire film. That shows up for maybe 3 minutes at a time each. So it's not a constant role throughout the entire film, but he does come up here and there at the more like pivotal points of the story.
When you need Patrick Stewart,
he does a good
he's
Patrick
there.
Stewart. Yeah. Oh yeah.
that's basically what happens. When you need him, you got him.
And he does really well. You would think as somebody who has the stage presence as Sir Patrick Stewart, you would assume like he would have more roles like that in his filmography. He just seems like a either a Shakespearean actor or like an Arthurian.
I was gonna say he's got tons of Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
Tons.
Yeah.
Hmm. Well, there you go. You gotta start going back through his filmography. But the rest of the film, mind you, so as I said, it's you have younger kids, a different interpretation of him in being introduced to Lance and Kay. I don't know. I know it's going to be vastly different, but I don't know how much. Like, I don't know the difference between how he meets Sir Lancelot and Sir Kay. Is it a sir? Or is
it's a sir, but I mean, he already knows Kay. Kay is his brother from growing up. From the family that he thought he was a part of, and then he learned later that he was actually given to them to keep him safe because he was in danger, because his half-sister Morgana, who is a witch in many of the stories, a sorceress, it's just all the names kind of cycle together, but the way that they're translated here is different. The relationships here are different.
Spence, the brother from the Sword and the Stone, that's Kay.
Oh.
I just realized...
Oh, okay.
I just realized that right now. I just remember. I'm
good
like,
on you.
I'm just like, oh, the adoptive. Wait, well, what was the guy's name that was at the castle in the cartoon? His name was Kay. Oh, so okay. I'm over that now. Thank you. But the direction they choose to go with kids as opposed to using adults, usually most of these films, aside from whatever Sunday morning abomination Spencer watched, most of the time these interpretations usually involve like older individuals. The ones that tend to be kids, it's usually like the more eternal characters, like immortal, like Merlin. Merlin seems to be somebody who, according to the legend, apparently he ages backwards.
He's been enchanted. Yeah. He falls in love with a nymph named Nimue, who's also a bit of an enchantress, and she ultimately they've blended some elements in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
So he basically, as I recall, I think he traps her in a tree or she traps him in a tree, And aside from that, he's also been cursed slash enchanted to age backwards, sort of like Benjamin Button.
Yeah.
And so the older he gets, the younger he gets. So he shows up in this movie as a teenager, suggesting that he's nearing-ish the end of his life cycle. And so when he conjures himself to look more his age, and that's when the character is played by Patrick Stewart, Sir Patrick Stewart. It takes a lot out of him because it's more genuine to what they should see, but he has to counter the enchantment upon him. But there was no real reason to go into that in this movie, aside from a gimmick to make sure that Patrick Stewart didn't have to do those goofy hand gestures.
Oh, he did them once.
He did it once, but like that was
but
like
the other kid did it like 8,000 times. It felt
that was like rapping in sign language. I couldn't keep up with whatever was happening with his hands. Just
that is one thing I will say I was kind of impressed with, is that he made some random hand gesture system for magic and then taught it to someone else because they had to do it in that movie.
Well, he did record it.
Yeah, well, okay, but like,
hey,
still.
We had kids around us in the theater, and they were practicing.
Yeah, so I was
again, it. I'm not the target audience for that kind of stuff, but it worked for the ones who are.
And that's one of the questions that I wanted to ask in terms of the film choosing to use kids as opposed to adults. Like I said, we've had several instances where most of the time it's usually adults. What was that other one with Keira Knightley was in it? What's his name? It was an Arthur film. I think it might have just been called Arthur.
King Arthur.
King Arthur.
With Clive Owen. Keira Knightley, and yeah.
But like those types of films, even the Guy Ritchie one, they're usually adults. Seeing as this film has kids as the main protagonist, do you think that hinders or it adds to the ability to tell this story properly? It's Chad.
I think that this movie did a decent job telling the story that this movie was trying to tell. Was it trying to retell the Arthurian saga? No, it wasn't, because they're routinely referencing a book about King Arthur, right? Like, so it's not as though there's never been a King Arthur and now it's as if King Arthur first manifests in the modern day.
Yeah.
This is really very much a, oh my goodness, my storybook story is coming to life and I'm a part of it. I mean, what kid doesn't think that every once in a while?
Yeah.
So it's a different kind of story, and it's not really trying to retell, you know, word for word, stride for stride, the Arthurian myth. And thank goodness, because there's some twisted stuff in what the myth has accumulated over the years in terms of just weird, creepy things that don't belong in a kid's movie.
Yeah, actually, and it's funny that you mentioned that, because I remember seeing in one of the mini series that you would binge, I remember watching one of them with you, and I remember a certain two individuals who have a certain type of relationship in the series, and then I remember seeing this and that relationship being very different, and it was like, wait, is that right, or was the series right? And you're like, no, the series kind of had it right the first time. This isn't how it's normally.
Yeah, but again, like, Alex is not Arthur.
Yeah.
Alex is Alex, and he has the character qualities of an Arthur-type person, and that's why Excalibur chose to manifest near him and let him draw it up out of the rubble of the building. Again, it's not one for one. I think they did a pretty good job tipping their hat as often as possible. You could tell that Joe Cornish and his team have a fondness for the source material, the legend, because there are just peppered references all throughout. I mean, all over the place. But then this is meant to be a story that stands on its own and says, okay, well, what if now was the time that the spirit of Arthur was supposed to come back to England to save it from a dark time or whatever? What would that look like? And that's sort of where this whole thing kicks off and starts running.
Spence, you have a few movie franchises that you're really big fans of. Like, you're a really big fan of, like, we were just talking actually before we went on the air about the
the Back to the Future franchise.
Right.
How would you feel if they decided to take the story in general of that and kind of create a somewhat continuation slash reinterpretation of it with kids? Like, what's your thoughts on a property being retranslated into a format where it's an all kids kind of production?
Well, I mean, they kind of did that with Back to the Future with the cartoon.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, I have all of those too, by the way.
You have all the cartoons?
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming that was a Saturday morning, not a Sunday morning.
It was, but yeah. It was later Saturday, so that was like your B team, C team type.
I see.
That was the CBS cartoons.
Yes.
Yeah.
You knew.
I saw that one, so.
Yeah, so like when it comes to like translating stories, like it's fine, but like it's not gonna be like hit the highs of like the original thing, at least not for like me. Like even as a kid, like I grew up watching like, you know, the movies and the cartoons, and like the movies just like struck more of a chord for me, even mm-hmm. though I was the target audience at the time for the cartoon. Even though there were things I liked about it, because like those cartoons had Bill Nye in them, so that was actually pretty awesome.
Mm.
Wow.
Yeah. So like I think you can translate things, but like sometimes they just won't hit like home, like, you know, other like source material does. But that doesn't mean it's bad per se. It really depends on how much care like the people who are trying to make the new thing are putting into it. And I guess that is one thing I can say about this movie, is that there was a lot of care done into it, even when things confused me or I didn't quite understand what certain characters were doing at certain points.
Yeah.
Like, I could tell there was a lot of care put into this movie.
Well, and going back to this film, the writer of the film is actually the director as well. Right. Joe Cornish did both the directing and the writing of the story, which he also did as well for Attack the Block. Which, if you haven't seen Attack the Block, really great alien invasion type film. John Boyega and a group of, you know, street kids band together to fight against this alien invasion that comes to London, and it's really fun. It's not overly like crazy or violent, but it does have its fun points. So,
and that's definitely something that you see here in, mm-hmm. in the sense of, I mean, you know, the age old adage, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Where you've got young people and then some sort of fantastical or supernatural opposing force, and the young people have to rise up. I mean, in this movie, the kids end up raising an army of their fellow schoolmates, arming them with swords, and they fight like zombie knights from under the ground.
Yeah.
In the halls of their school. So, I mean, and then obviously eventually also Morgana. Mm-hmm. The dragon sorceress
that
lady
turned into the crypt keeper at the end of the film.
Yeah, oh, she sure did. But there's definitely some continuity, I think, for Joe Cornish in terms of sort of the buildup of Attack the Block and then the buildup of the kid who would be king.
Yeah. And it's like we said, this is his sophomore film, so it's his second film, his second directing opportunity for a film. So it's interesting to see the consistency that happens with a director. Most of the times, like with M. Night Shyamalan, we talked about him last mm-hmm. week reviewing Glass. With M. Night Shyamalan, he was consistent for two films, and then he started kind of teetering a bit with the third one, and then it started going downhill after the fourth one, and the fifth, sixth, and seventh were just completely gone or out the window. And he was recently on the kind of rise with some of the more recent films, but the inconsistency is what I'm getting at. And to see somebody who, like Joe Cornish, coming into the fray and really giving us films that you can market to kids, but there's also a small but still present audience that can enjoy this film. It's really great to see that, you know, because we don't get a lot of great kid directed type films if it's, you know, not coming out of like the House of Mouse or Pixar or any of the other like DreamWorks or whatnot. most of the films that usually are marketed towards kids, they come out of those conglomerates. So I think it's really great seeing that opportunity in other studios.
And I would say, too, as an adult, I had a better time watching this movie because there were kids in the theater with us.
Mm.
Like, there were young boys behind us and down the same row as us and kind of in front of us, and you could hear them, mm-hmm. like, interacting with the movie. You could hear them laughing or talking or trying to mimic the weird hand gestures that Merlin was doing to duplicate things or get people to do what he wanted them to do or whatever it was. And as an adult, if I was just sitting there with you guys, no kids in the theater, I really wouldn't have enjoyed it as much.
Yeah.
But because we saw it in the theater with kids who are the target, it's sort of like that scene in Finding Neverland where J.M. Barrie, played by Johnny Depp, mm-hmm. insists on the theater manager setting aside seats throughout the theater for kids from the orphanage to watch the play. And they come in and they sit down, and all the adults are there in their, like, very formal wear and whatever. And the kids are, you know, dressed up too. But, like, when the jokes start happening and things, the kids are, like, the wonder and the humor and the everything. And so the adults have a better time watching the show.
I remember that.
You know, and so that's the way that I felt. I often feel when we see movies in the theater that are made for kids and we're in the theater with a bunch of kids around,
mm-hmm.
it does make the experience richer to me because I have an active imagination. I remember what it was like to be a kid, but I'm not a kid. My preferences and expectations are in a different place. But to see a movie made for kids that kids are enjoying, it makes it more fun for me.
How do you feel about that, Spence?
I remember you shushed the child.
Thank you for bringing this up, Spencer. This is a topic we need to dig in on a little bit. Tell me more.
I didn't even notice kid. And, like, all of a sudden, Eddie turns his head and he's like, shh. And I'm like, what are you doing? What are you doing to this child? You're ruining his movie experience.
Eddie is the king of indiscriminate shushing.
This is part of a long trend.
I am a respecter of no man.
Or boy.
Or boy.
Or girl. You shushed like a 2-year-old girl one time.
That was
like years ago.
No, wasn't that for Overboard?
No, that was with you.
Well,
oh yeah, you wasn't there for that.
That was a toddler.
Oh gosh.
It was, you know what?
What are you expecting to happen?
Here's the thing. That was a more grown-up movie.
That was more shushing the parent for bringing the child in the first place.
Exactly.
Don't give him
ammo. No. But, okay, so in my defense, seeing this movie,
right. There
were two kids, which, mind you, I was well aware. There was a young child behind us as well that was totally into the film. And I was cool on her making her comments because she was talking about the film. She was talking about how cool this was and how cool that was. And
not like yelling.
No. I mean, and
they were pretty respectful.
It was very, very, very respectful. The two boys, however, on the other side of Chad, which mm-hmm. were only like 3-4 chairs away, they decided to carry like a very normal voiced conversation in a room full of people who were watching a movie at one of the higher points of the film. And I turned and looked, and I looked, and they were talking, and then they turned and looked this way, and then they kept talking. And I'm like, don't make me be that person. But they kept talking, and I kept kind of leaning out so they could see that I noticed them, because I didn't want to shush them. This is a kid's movie. I know. Don't give me that look, Spencer. I see just the judgmental eyes right over that microphone.
All I'm saying is I was like right next to you and then I didn't hear any kids.
And then, well, because you were on the right of me. This was happening on the left
of me. So the sound stopped at you is what you're saying?
Exactly. I'm a big guy. So on top of them talking, they decided to start making noises with the bottom of their popcorn little plastic
things.
Yeah,
that
things.
Part was bad. They started actually chewing on them.
Is that what that was?
One of the boys put the plastic container in his mouth and was chewing on it.
There were goats in the theater. There were goats.
None of this.
So
that's pretty remarkable that you didn't hear that part, because it was pronounced. It was very loud.
Yeah.
The only thing I noticed in the theater was whatever that person was doing that was flashing the screen.
Yeah, at the beginning.
That's the only thing I noticed.
We may have to do just a whole episode on like theater etiquette.
Yeah, theater etiquette. Like,
people are bad at it.
Because it's like, seriously, how do you not know to respect other people? I'm not talking about the kids talking, whatever. That's a whole different thing. But like people who are taking pictures in the middle of the theater, in the middle of a movie, or like that.
Or bringing a baby to an R-rated film.
Or being a baby at an R-rated film.
All oh, of yeah, that. Glass.
Yeah,
all that's that. What I'm talking we talked about that on our last episode. Good
yeah,
night.
So mind you, yes, after all that, going back to the story, yes, after all that, I did lean over and said, shh, because they were making noise. Now, mind you, it didn't do diddly, because they were still making noise, and I was just like, ah, whatever, and I turned and I kept watching the movie. That was the end of it. I could have continued. I could have re-thrown out my shush, but I left it at that. Thank you.
From my perspective, what I heard was nothing, nothing, nothing. Eddie going, shh, and then a continuation of nothing.
See,
nothing.
That's how good of a friend I am to you, Spencer, is that I will lean forward to catch all those wave vibrations of their sound, so that way you don't get any of that.
I learned how science worked from Bill Nye, and I know that's not how it works.
I will take those sound waves and let them hit me, and I will take the brunt of that for you.
This is a beautiful moment. I feel like this is a public service announcement gone wrong. I think that's what this moment has been.
But back to the movie. One of the things I really wanted to bug Chad, because I told Chad after the film ended, I told him, look, I still, even after we saw the Guy Ritchie film, I don't really know much about this story in terms of its history and where it's changed over the course of time, how much has it changed? How much from the original tale all the way through time to now? Has things moved and changed? You know, are characters still the same and whatnot? So I wanted to get Chad's opinion on how accurate this film was, or to some extent, to the overall Arthurian tale. Because, like we said, in terms of any film that's within this story continuity, I guess if you want to call it, because it's this film, like I said, doesn't exactly remake the Arthurian legend. It is more of like a continuation. It's like time and fate revisits,
right,
for the sake of Britain.
I mean, like, you know, King Arthur with Clive Owen and Keira Knightley and a few others, that was sort of a let's try to be more grounded in the historical time period of when the Romans were in the land and the Picts were against them, and you know, that kind of warfare. Guinevere was a Pict in that version of the story, and you know, part of the tree tribe or whatever, the sky people, I don't remember what they all were, but they had, you know, paint
that was Keira Knightley's character.
Everything. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And Clive Owen was a Roman general or a soldier of some sort, a centurion or whatever. But the but then your more traditional Arthur stories, they're not particularly Roman per se.
No.
There's like a good amount of the Knights of the Round Table come from the peasant class, and they're just either virtuous already, or by virtue of joining Arthur's quest to unite the land, they become virtuous. And you've got other elements there too. I mean, there were elements that were not part of this film that are really great parts of the Arthurian cycle. So you've got like, you know, you got Gawain, you've got the Green Knight, you've got Percival, you've got a whole host of others, various different names, and they all have, you know, big moments in a battle, or they have certain quests that they all go on, because very similar to, like, if you can imagine, you know, Homer's Odyssey or the Iliad or whatever, it's a collection of small stories.
Okay.
The characters cycle through, and there are a lot of, you know, phrases and moments that are like a refrain, because it was a way of kind of packaging in, this is how this part of the story goes, and then you transition to the next part, because you would have to memorize the entire thing. It was shared word of mouth. It wasn't written down. And now, but then with the Arthurian cycles, they also, a lot of them began as songs. and
oh, okay.
Then they were stitched together. Some of them really weren't all that connected until somebody said, oh, let's put this one with that one and mash them together. And now this, you know, whatever is a part of Arthur's round table of knights. And let's figure out how to get them integrated and whatever. So they change form and everything over time. But
yeah,
I think by the time you get to this film, though, like there's so much of the supporting cast and storyline that is just not necessary for a two-hour kids movie set in the modern day.
Which, by the way, this movie was 2 hours long.
Yeah, I mean, you don't need to touch it. All you need is a kid who has virtue like Arthur, Merlin the wizard, the sorceress Morgana, and maybe a couple other characters. That's all you really need.
Yeah.
And that's all they really have. It's pretty stripped down. I thought one of the coolest things about it actually was the settings, because as much as I've read and watched movies and whatnot, to have something that's like in the modern day, so they like visit Stonehenge, for example, or they visit Tintagel, which is an island off of Cornwall. And I've never known what that looks like, but it's a part of the stories. It's where Arthur is born.
The story itself.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, it was kind of cool seeing, you know, granted in, you know, 2018 or 2019 or whatever, this is what that area maybe looks like if they filmed in the accurate location, which I've never been to England. I can't tell you one way or the other, but it was kind of cool just seeing, oh, maybe that's the legitimate place. It's not a computer generated castle. It's not a set on a back lot somewhere. It's an on location.
It's a physical place. Yeah.
So maybe that is almost like if I took my little like Arthurian mythology guidebook and I walked hither and yon across the land of England and I tried to visit all the places that are name dropped, maybe some of them, you know, were shown in this movie.
Yeah.
So I thought that was pretty cool.
I think the idea of creating this film. So, just on my knowledge of films itself, because the only area of expertise that I can really talk on when it comes to this particular movie is the actual like film aspect and logistics-wise, but I think one of the great things about this film is that it is self-aware of the fact that it's reinterpreting the story itself. It's not so much as like trying to recreate it, but it's establishing a reinterpretation of what would happen if, you know, this story continued. It was actual historical fact, and the fact that, you know, when Britain would be in turmoil and it would be split and, you know, the sword would find a new leader and so forth, continuing that. This film makes several mentions of the fact that the story that Alex has, because he has a physical copy of the Arthurian tale,
yes.
They make several mentions of the fact that in this movie, the stories that he was reading wasn't historically correct. Like there was other things that happened. Like the version that he has is someone's version.
Yes.
But that through the course of time, like facts have been muddied and truths have been stretched and things have happened. And so that's what you have now, the story that he had in his hands. But that there are other things that happens, and ultimately that Alex can recreate his own story, that he can pen his own journey, so to speak. And I think that's a great way how Joel Cornish actually lets the audience know that, you know what, we're not creating another, you know, King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table type film. We're creating a story that is based in that, but it's still very much its own. It still has roots into that, but it's going to be a unique film nevertheless.
And it's pretty well self-contained.
Exactly.
I mean, you've got beginning, middle, end all in this movie. It's not necessarily set up for a sequel.
No.
It's not meant to be the start of a new like kid King Arthur franchise.
Yeah.
It's really standalone.
Which is a good thing, because I don't know if the way this film continues on, I don't know if there's room for that kind of a franchise to continue.
You'd have to diverge more and more. I mean, there would be elements you could pull in. I mean, let's be honest, if you wanted to, you could pull in the Holy Grail, because that's a part of the Arthurian cycle. Because the Arthurian cycle for Northern mainland Europe and the UK was kind of like, for a while, it was sort of like comic books or soap operas, right? Uh-huh. It was like the popular set of stories to tell and to share. And so it just accumulated a lot of things, like pieces of legend that were not originally part of the Arthur legend were grafted in because the Arthur legend was the popular one. So it's sort of like, you know, you take your MCU, right? And you start telling a portion of your stories about the Norse god Thor, right? Like you, you took it from mythology and you've grafted it onto sort of like a modern mythology legend storytelling thing. And now Thor has further adventures that reflect some of what's in Norse mythology, but then it's really new stuff too.
Yeah.
So it's just sort of, you know, you hodgepodge a little bit, you know, different popular elements that a lot of people have shown interest in.
Yeah. And as we mentioned earlier, because of this and because of the care that's taken into this film, you can truly tell that Joe Cornish not only did his research, because he is listed as the sole writer to this film, but not only did he do the research, but he also cares about the overall story, like the Arthurian legend itself. He cares about that enough to not create like something that's egregious to fans or literary aficionados, if you will, to the actual legend itself. It's still something that can be a delight to watch if you're a child or if you're even older and you have an affinity towards this, you know, story. So I think that's one thing to really highlight that I'd like to highlight is Joe Cornish's ability to create a cohesive story and be able to really translate that. This is his own interpretation. This is his own version, if you will, but it still gives homage. It's not a copy. It's not a recreation. It's just his take and him kind of adding an additional color to the palette that's already been painted. So
what I mean, it's very similar to, like, you know, The Force Awakens, where there are a lot of elements in that movie that are almost identical, but then like somewhat polished differently or changed or adjusted to not be exactly like A New Hope.
Yeah.
But like, I mean, there's a lot in that movie that's meant to feel nostalgic for those of us who have followed the franchise for a while. Like it's there's very little in that movie that is truly new.
Yeah.
Because it's meant to feel familiar but reshaped. And I think that's very similar here. It's familiar, but it's reshaped.
What about you, Spence? Is there anything in terms of this film that was a highlight for you? Anything that stuck out? Anything that you really enjoyed? Or on the opposite side of that spectrum, was there anything about this film that just really peeved you, that you just really wish that you had stepped out of the room and not watched? Which, looking at your face during the first third of the film, I was like, I can't tell if he's enjoying it or he has gas or something. What's his face doing?
Okay, like, a lot of my problems with this movie are like the logistics of what of an impact of what people say and do. Because there's certain things that, like, I know you can hand wave it because, like, oh, it's a kid's film, but like, what are you talking about when you say this? For instance, everyone like refers to Alex as like the once and future king, but like, I don't know what that means. Like, they already have a royal family in England.
Anarchy, Spencer. They're talking about them? Anarchy.
Like, I this is an honest question to both of you. Like, what is that supposed to mean?
Oh, you're looking at the wrong guy here. You got to look over there.
It's attached to King Arthur. King Arthur is the once and future king. He was the champion who rallied everybody together, and even though he ended up dying, there's a belief that he will come back to rescue England and unify it again at some future point in time.
Okay, so he's...
So the once and future king is a reference to Arthur, and then in this film, they apply it to Alex because he kind of exhibits the characteristics of a young Arthur.
Okay, so it's just that he exhibits characteristics of Arthur and is not actually king of anything.
Correct.
Okay. That bothered me for a bit. Because I was like, I don't understand.
That was literally at the beginning of the movie, and you were confused the entire time for that? For 2 hours?
Because it kept coming back up. Like, what is he the king of? I don't understand.
Like, who's the king of the jungle?
Just change, like, London, like, England's entire, like, government?
Yeah.
By pulling a sword out of stone?
Yeah.
And, like, also, like, another thing that bothered me was, like, these, like, so they have these, like, the rules. What are they called?
The Chivalric Code.
Yes, that. Didn't, like, Merlin and the original Arthur fail that code because they didn't actually follow through with Morgana? Because that's one of the rules. Because, like, they kind of just banished her.
Yeah, they didn't finish the job, and therefore she's coming back.
Yeah, like, how did they get away with that? But then Merlin is all, like, in a huff when Alex doesn't follow it. Like, isn't that kind of hypocritical?
For sure. Merlin,
talk about finding the thread and pulling it apart and being like, and another thing, the color of Morgana's hair.
This is good. This is legit. We should have had you talking earlier. Merlin is not, holistically, if you look at the entire Merlin part of the story, I guess you could say, Merlin is not necessarily a fully good guy. Like, he's not a good, he's on the side of the good guys, but right, he does some sketchy, questionable things throughout.
Yeah, no, I totally agree,
including conspiring to make sure that Arthur is conceived in the first place. So, sort of like, I mean, we were talking on our last episode, 146,
yeah,
about Elijah Price, right? How he's ridiculously intelligent, and he's manipulated all these things for so many years to make these people manifest their superhuman abilities or whatever. So Merlin basically is connected to Uther Pendragon, who is Arthur's biological father. And Merlin, knowing that Arthur's going to come, that the king, the uniting king element, is going to come from Uther's line, Merlin sort of, I don't know, conjures up a spell and disguises Uther as his enemy, the Duke of Cornwall.
Okay.
And Uther, as his enemy, looking like his opponent, goes through enemy lines, says hey to the guys, goes back to the guy's castle, and sleeps with his wife. And that's where Arthur comes from.
That's very Zeus of him.
So, and Merlin is very much aware, like, he helped make it happen, and he's aware of what's happening because he has ulterior motives. So Merlin is very much usually depicted as a questionable character. And in this case, I would say it's pretty consistent to say, well, he screwed up before, but now he's holding this 12-year-old boy up to a code that he wasn't even willing to follow.
Well, because, like, for even sure, during the movie, he does questionable things.
Yeah.
Like, whenever some adult asks him something he doesn't want to answer, he just does some magic and then brainwashes them and then sticks them all in a room.
Yeah, lame.
Like, that doesn't seem like on the up and up there, buddy. Like, I don't know. Just little things about the movie kind of, like, bothered me, where it just seemed like the movie was doing, like, a doublespeak thing like that.
Yeah, well, and Merlin, and again, Merlin's easy to get wrong. Merlin is a character that kind of perpetually occupies both worlds in a way that very few other characters in literary history really do. I mean, he fully occupies the physical world, but he almost completely occupies the spiritual world as well, because he's a wizard. So he his motives are different. His means of achieving things are different. Sometimes he disappears at inopportune times and reappears at inopportune times. And he kind of, like, he's on board with all of them, but he also has his own agenda at the same time.
Right. Interesting.
Seems like a very, like, I don't know if I'd want to have Merlin on hand to do anything. I'd be worried, be like, hey, we got to go and go slay the dragon. Merlin here, do you want me to go get... No, no, don't get him. It's good. We got this. Just let him stay in his dungeon. We're good. What else, Spencer, since you've opened up this uh,
this lovely can of not understanding the full parts of the film. I'm trying to understand like a lot of what else you got going on. It's interesting.
No, that was kind of it for the most part. Like the only other thing really was like at first I thought Alex and Betters weren't friends because like I didn't know that there was like what's his name
Bedivere. Sir Bedivere is the character in the original legend.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of like name calling because like I thought he was trying to say he was like a bedwetter. So he named him Betters because like, it could have been a character limit or something.
Well, they bedwetter.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, okay, I can see that.
That's it. That's all I got.
Well, on that note, but honestly, all in all, I think in terms of the story from beginning to end, from a film story standpoint, I do enjoy the fact that it does have it has your three-part act kind of thing, or well, technically it's a five, but it has all the right structure of a cohesive story. It gives you a great climax to the whole film, and it gives you resolution to this tale that takes 2 hours to get through, but it's not like a dragging type 2 hours. It actually has certain parts. It flows really well. A lot of the action sequences, they're not too watered down to where it doesn't seem like actual peril. Like, it looks like they're really in danger. And because sometimes, you know how in kids' films, certain instances of like danger and whatnot, it gets watered down to just like, oh, this kid is on the fourth step of a ladder and he's falling. Oh, no, danger. Like, sometimes they equate it that way.
Oh, no, danger.
Like,
I love that example. I've never seen that done on screen, but I love it.
Well, I'm just saying. But in this film, there's an earnest sense of dread and doom and danger and a looming fear of what would happen if Morgana takes over the Earth.
Yep.
And it's all translated well to the kids, and they understand it. And the story is beautifully told, plain and simple. So I do appreciate that aspect of the film, and I think Joe Cornish, from what he's done with Attack the Block and this one, it's pretty consistent, and I'm excited to see.
I think that one of the things that was really appealing about this story was how almost instructive it is for a young person, because it really is about virtue. It is about character qualities that are good and praiseworthy and we should be instilling in our kids, and kids should be striving to embody and all of that. If you did something with, you know, like modernizing the Arthur story, but making the main characters older, even high school older.
Yeah.
But especially, you know, like adult older or high school older, the way that you tell the story would be different, and it would not necessarily be about like who you are on the inside and being a heroic person.
Yeah.
It would be more like dragon slaying and whatever, and
being
snarky but still redeemable, and what, like, there would be a lot more texture to it.
Yeah.
And the virtuous, like the chivalry of it, might go by the wayside. But because you're dealing with younger protagonists, you're really focused more on the character qualities and the virtues that make you a hero or make you a knight of the chivalric code of Arthur or whatever, you know. And I think that there's something a little more basic about that I found appealing.
And I think that's one of the things, because you bring up a really great point. Yes, there are a very limited amount of moments that I can reflect back on that directly reference the Arthurian tale. But as we've been talking, I've been thinking about it, and there have been several instances now that I, you know, really reflect, where many stories, many TV series, many movies have created that sense of the Arthurian legend, but put into a different package. And like the first thing that came to mind, I'm like, Spence, like Power Rangers is literally like sci-fi King Arthur. Like you have your Knights of the Round Table, you have Zordon as like this King Arthur person who sends him out to do battle. And
oh no, Zordon is totally Merlin.
Or, yeah. And you know, Alpha.
He's literally a wizard.
He's literally the floating head of a wizard in a tube.
But I say like there are several instances where, unbeknownst to us, which perfect example if you listen to the episode earlier in, our limited amount of like references back to this story is like 0 to 1. we both had a Disney film from the like 60s, and Spencer pulled out some weird Sunday morning cartoon about gems and jewels and writing jewelry with Guinevere or something. I don't know. But either way, it's great to see that, you know what, there are other instances of this story being told, and in instances where even if you don't recognize it, it's there. And the fact that it does focus on the children aspect of the audience, it can create that connection with friendship and with understanding like bullying, like recognizing, you know, how to, you know, go the other direction when it comes to being bullied or how to treat other people, or even the idea of like what's it called? The chivalric.
It's chivalry.
Chivalry. So, the code of chivalry. But like even those things, like those are great little moral lessons for kids to take home with them as well, and kind of look into that and really try to live that out. So I think as a film as a whole, as much as I loved a lot of the action sequences, which like you were saying, some of the more older individuals, they'll obviously like those types of interpretations better if the characters were older. Like there would be more focus on the action, the controversy, if you will, whatnot. But like the fact that it really dials in this kid interpretation.
Well, I mean, you get things like, for example, when at a certain time of night,
mm-hmm.
There are these like zombie horse riding knights of old who come up out of the ground and they're on fire and they want to like get the sword back from Alex, and only Alex and anyone that he has physically knighted with the sword are still around. Like all of the mm-hmm. adults disappear, anyone who hasn't been knighted disappears, and so you've got that whole like only you, child of promise, only you can see these things and fix them, you know. And I think that there's something fairly universal that speaks there, and it leads to, as he knights more kids,
yeah,
it leads to things like kids driving cars when they're not really used to driving cars and they learned on Mario Kart. Like it's yeah. somewhat gimmicky, but at the same time it's empowering, and in a way that captures and keeps your attention.
Yeah.
You know, the danger is real. You're the only one on stage, let's say, who can take care of it. Like it has to be you, or, you know, y'all, because there are four of them. But like yeah. it has to be you guys. And when you get to the final battle in the school, he knights all the kids in the school. But like anyone who hasn't been knighted, like all the adults and the rest of London and whatever, like they all disappear.
Yeah.
While Morgana and her forces are coming to take over the world. And so it's only the kids in this school who are there to fix the problem. And I think that there's something that's, you know, pretty appealing about that, especially for kids to say like, oh, wow, I can do this.
Yeah.
I can be a hero.
So wrapping this up, let's go ahead and go around the table and give our thoughts. Does the film pass or fail, and how many monocles? And I'm going to pass it to Señor Guinevere over here, and let's go ahead and start with his, you know, jewel writing and give us whether or not this film passes or fails, and how many monocles. You and your Sunday morning cartoons. How dare you?
What? That's what was on. Jeez. Okay. Yeah, this movie passes for me.
Okay.
It's a pretty good film. The music in this film was pretty
yeah.
nice.
Yeah.
Like, very, like, synthy, like, Stranger Things-esque, even though I know Stranger Things did not originate that, but it's the closest, like, viewpoint I've got. Music was pretty good. There was some oddness in it, but, like, you know, overall, like, you're not going to be upset if you're stuck in a theater and it's on. So, I give it a 3 out of 5.
Okay, okay. The film passes for me. I actually, now that you brought that up, I have to at least give credit in that aspect. I did really, like, love actually, the soundtrack, the score that was accompanying this film, the way it pieced together with the scenes and whatnot, I'm a big synth person. I like, you know, when synth is used properly and it's not just a background piece, but it's a part of the film and it adds to, it doesn't just distract and it's not noise. It actually makes sense in it. And I liked it. I was able to kind of dig in a little bit more as I was watching the film because of the soundtrack. And I mean, that's just my personal preference. It's not, there's no actual, you know, movie knowledge, education, you know, foundation behind what I'm saying in terms of like, oh, well, if it has synth, it makes the movie that much better. For me, I just like synth, so it worked for me. So the film passes, and in terms of Monocles, I'm going to give it 3.5 out of 5. I had a good time with it. I think it does really well. I do think the runtime is a little too long for 2 hours, especially when you're trying to, you know, sell it to kids and have them stay engaged for the full 2 hours. There's a certain point in time where kids, you know, their attention span does begin to diminish no matter how much you have on the screen, how many colors, how many things are moving. It's really hard
to
keep them.
They start eating their popcorn containers.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm going to give it 3.5 out of 5. Chadley.
Yeah, I'll pass the film because it doesn't like royally screw anything up.
No.
So it's going to get a win from me. I think I'll also give it 3.5 because there are some drawbacks. I mean, I'm not the target audience, and I wasn't a fan of Merlin's hand gestures. Like, it was really annoying to me, especially the frequency of how often he used his hands to do goofy things. Like, once or twice, fine. 18 times within 2 hours, that's overboard. The kids trying to mimic some of it kind of rebounded. It was a bit of a rebound for me because it was like, oh, okay, it works for them. They're trying to control their parents with, you know, their hand gestures or whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's cute enough. But I would say 3.5 overall. I would have, honestly, I would have liked more Patrick Stewart. I would have liked more of actual Rebecca Ferguson.
Yeah.
Versus like CGI Dragon Lady.
Yeah.
With Rebecca Ferguson's voice. Like, they are captivating performers who obviously signed on because there wasn't a lot of time required from them. But I would have appreciated them being used a bit more because they did have more presence and gravitas than any of the other players whenever they were around.
That's very true, because there is a scene towards the tail end where you actually see both of them in the same scene, and it was actually a pretty impactful scene, you know, how that works out for them. But that's the only time they're ever, her and Sir Patrick Stewart, that's the only time where you see that, and it's as great as it is, it doesn't happen any other time other than that point. So, but yeah, that about wraps up another awesome episode of The Filmlosophers. Remember, you can let us know what you thought about this film. Have you had a chance to see it? Did you like it? Did you not like it? What were your thoughts? Have you even heard of this Princess Guinevere and the Jewel Riders?
Oh, I was going to say, given the box office take of this film, pretty much none of you have seen it. Understandable.
It's
And this is Super Bowl weekend, so let's be honest, you're not going to see it.
Very true.
This time around.
But if you do get a chance to, let us know. Drop us your thoughts on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosophers or our Twitter page at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Before we go, we're going to let you know of a couple upcoming weekend releases. We got Miss Bala debuting this weekend. It's the, I believe, Gina Rodriguez. Gina Rodriguez, the actress playing a woman who gets taken by drug dealers and whatnot. Either way, if you get a chance, check it out. If not, go check out the King Arthur film, The Kid Who Would Be King, and let us know your thoughts. We'd love to hear them. But yeah, so from all of us here at The Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
I'm Spence.
Class dismissed.